Hey guys, welcome to Overcrest. I'm Jake, and we're going to be doing something a little different for this week's episode. We are getting into kind of the thick of things with rally planning, and for the next few episodes, Chris is going to be out scouting in the middle of Oregon, and so we may actually be checking in with him from the road and looking at a little bit of that process and what goes into it and what you guys can expect to see and what's going forward with rally prep. And so there's so many things going on behind the scenes, and we're really trying to amp this up and make this A, bigger and better than ever, and B, more accessible to more of you guys who want to get out there, because we realize like it is a very small percentage of people that get to go out on the rally versus who you, our listeners, are. So we're trying to find different ways to include as many people as possible and bring the experience to many more people. So all of that is to say that you're stuck with me for this intro, sans Chris. However, I do have something really cool and special for you. So years ago, I'm pulling this out of the archive, because years ago, we had something a little different. We actually recorded a live podcast for the North Star BMW Club's annual banquet up here in Minnesota. And so we were on site for this dinner, and we were their entertainment, and we wanted to do something a little different, and not only kind of explain and expound on the ethos of Overcrest, and that is taking the car and exploring and kind of explaining a little bit about what we do, but I also wanted to dig into kind of some obscure history that these guys would dig. But being BMW guys, I'm thinking, well, there's probably not a whole lot they know, or don't know rather, about the history of these cars, right? Like, oh, it's an old German company that used to make airplanes. What else is there? Well, let me tell you, I dug deeper to find something that they did not know, and yeah, no, we got into it. It's a really cool, obscure chapter of BMW and the company's history that I think you guys are really going to enjoy, as well as kind of our broader discussion of Overcrest. And we dig into some of the stories that we've alluded to in the past and on my and Chris's road trips we've done. And so it's going to be, I think, really cool. I just listened to this again to kind of go through it and figure out if this is worth airing. And I really do like this episode. I think you will as well. Before we get into it, though, of course, let's talk about our sponsor, Petrolbox. You know, we've been talking about Petrolbox for years now on the podcast, literally years. And I have a feeling that a very small percentage of people who actually listen to the podcast have taken advantage and experienced Petrolbox. And I would just say, what are you waiting for? Petrolbox, as many of you know, it's a monthly service made specifically for automotive enthusiasts, right? So each month, they carefully select items, including tools, you get your detailing supplies, you get apparel, usually you get like some sort of brush or detailing tool along with whatever the detailing supply is. You have garage gear, stickers, publications, pins, a lot of times t-shirts, and it's a selection of kind of the latest and greatest new gear in the industry that's really cool to be able to experience as it comes right to your doorstep. So if you haven't tried these guys out, I implore you to head over to mypetrolbox.com. You can use the code OVERCREST, that's all caps, at checkout. That gets you a discount. So how about this? Either next time you have a birthday gift that you need to buy for a friend of yours who is an automotive car girl guy, enthusiast, think of Petrolbox. It's a really cool gift. You can choose as many months to give as a subscription for the gift. Or if, you know, one of your relatives or your wife comes to you and says, hey, what do you want for your birthday this year? And the problem is, at least with me, I end up buying a lot of the things I need right away anyways, especially with the advent of Amazon Prime. It's way too easy. And I go, oh, yeah, I don't know what I want. Well, hey, if you're like that, Petrolbox is a great gift, not only for someone else, but for yourself. It's very cool. Check those guys out. All right, without further ado, here we are with our, this was our first ever live recording of the podcast, and I hope you guys enjoy.
A lot of these cars that I've had, I've gone out and traveled for. The 996 I traveled for, the C43 AMG I traveled for, got stranded in a blizzard. In this next car, I've also traveled for, And it is a this car, I'm using this trip as an example that it's not necessarily about the car. It's more about where you're going and where you've been. And I always tell people to make friends not only with the road, but with each other. And in that way, it doesn't necessarily matter what car you're driving. So this car is a 1988 Yugo GV. So this is well known as one of the worst cars ever made, right? It's absolutely horrible. It has, I think it's got a Fiat engine.
It does, yeah.
It has a Fiat engine in it.
124 engine, I believe.
It's terrible. Top speed of 84 miles per hour, and that took...
Proven.
It took a very, very long time to get there. So Jake and I went up to...
it was North Dakota?
Fargo. It was out north
of
Fargo.
It was past Fargo.
I saw this thing on Craigslist. It said, Jake, let's go get this Yugo.
And I said... why?
Why do you want to go get this Yugo? I'm like, I don't know. It'll be a fun road trip. We get to be our first road trip together as podcast partners. Let's go do it. Let's take the. So we took my wagon up there, and ended up at this small, really, really, really small town, yep, way north of North Dakota, and met a guy who said,
and that's by North Dakota standards, it only had one bar in it.
Yes, and I think it was closed, yeah, so that's not saying much. And it had a car wash and a few other things. And everything was dirt roads, dirt driveways, really nothing there. And we meet the guy that I bought the car from, and he's like, oh, you do car club stuff. He kind of looked me up on the internet before I came up there. And he's like, yeah, I founded the AMX Club here in this town. And it's more of a that was the car that he had shoved in his garage, was this old AMX that he bought brand new. So he bought that car brand new, went on his first date with his wife in that car. It was absolutely a fantastic story. This is the guy right there. And I kind of feel bad I ended up selling the car 3 months later just because I was kind of like, it's a Yugo. It was easily the worst. There's no real front springs. It's kind of like an Audi. There's just a sway bar that goes across the front, and that's all there is for springs. So it's just all over the place.
Yeah, but you did lower it. Before selling it,
I did lower it. Everything must be lowered. Yeah. You lower all the things. But then he invited us into his basement, and I'm like, well, this is absolutely 100% where I am going to get murdered. He's in this small town. I'm like, he's taking us in the basement, but he had this train collection. And I looked at some of the trains. I don't know what I'm looking at. And I said, what is some of this stuff worth? What does it cost? And he's like, well, this train right here is worth about $15,000. I said, oh, my God, that's like five of these Yugos. This is absolutely fantastic.
That's why you're selling it.
Yeah,
get more
so he could buy more trains. He could buy like one-third of a train that he likes with the cost of this Yugo. So anyway, the guy was super nice. We ended up driving home. And this is, everybody asked, like, how do you find the cars that you buy? And this is a pretty good example of this. This is on Highway 10 somewhere in Minnesota. I don't really remember where. I spy out of my eye, and I'm a big Volkswagen guy too. So I've owned probably 20 Volkswagen Rabbits over the course of time. That was my first car when I was 16. I always have a really special place in my heart for those. So I can always see them. It's like I have this rabbit radar. If they're on the side of the road, it's like, there's another one. And I saw these from at least 300 yards away through two little tiny trees and a garage. I saw the headlight. I knew, even with no headlight, I knew exactly what it was. So we turn around and accelerate back up to 30 miles an hour in 10 minutes to turn around and go find out.
Yeah, he's driving the Yugo, does a U-turn on the middle of the freeway. I'm like, what is going on? I thought he lost a wheel. Turns out he goes, no, we got to go check out these random Volkswagens in the middle of a field.
In the middle of a field. So I go up and I knock on the door, and nobody answers. And I kind of wait. I knock on the door again. Nobody answers. And I start to walk away, and I hear the door open, and this guy, very big man. Obviously, I think he ended up being from Norway or the Netherlands or something. Mm-hmm. Very tall, stocky guy comes out. He's like, hey, boys, how's it going? And he was probably 95, 97 years old.
He was up there.
This guy was, he was
Lloyd.
Up there. Oh, yeah.
Lloyd.
Lloyd, yes. Lloyd was his name. Good old Lloyd. He had a red shirt on, blue jean overalls, comes lumbering out. I said, hey, I saw that you've got a couple rabbits back there. And my first inclination was to buy one, right? I'm like, I still wanted to buy the thing. It's beautiful. And it ended up there. They weren't for sale. They were all just his. But we walk out there, look at the cars, and he's like, you know, I've got a couple more. So as we're walking back from these two cars, I see that his wife, there's a Beetle sitting over on the pavement. I said, is that your wife's car? It had the eyelashes on it. You know, you got the little Beetle with the eyelashes. And he's like, yeah, it was. And then it was this kind of weird thing where
He got quiet for a
He
moment.
Got quiet, and it was, you know, when you had those old tube televisions, you'd turn it off and the little thing would go like this and the TV would kind of turn right. That's what happened in his eyes. And he says, yeah, that's my wife's Beetle. She passed away about 2 weeks ago. And so then I'm like, oh, man, this is. And he said he hadn't had anybody come by in a long time. Mm-hmm. So then I decided we're going to spend as much time with Lloyd as we possibly could. So he takes us back to his warehouse, which is kind of like four.
It was a couple old just pole barns.
Yeah,
back
pole
there.
Barns, but they're all kind of like Lego together. Like, who did this kind of thing? They didn't really. Nothing really made sense. There was doors all over the place. It totally didn't make sense. But we go in there. It's dark, and there's a couple rabbits, and then there's a cabriolet, and I think there was a bronco.
There was a bronco that was mint condition.
Mint. Everything in there was absolutely mint. Perfect. This stuff sitting outside is like no representation of what was inside. So I said, hey, what's this car for? And he had his cabriolet sitting there. He's like, oh, I built that for my grandson. This thing was perfect, okay? It was really, really, really nice. As a Volkswagen guy, I'm like, wow, this thing is a 10 out of 10. And at that point, I kind of like reeled myself back in with wanting to buy any of these cars or any of this stuff because I didn't want to, with his wife just passing away, I didn't want to take anything from him. This stuff that he had was kind of this, his private property of these cars was a representation of his time that he spent acquiring this stuff. So he's like, yeah, I built that for my grandson. He's not really interested. And I just, like, my heart was just breaking for Lloyd.
We were like, Lloyd, we'll be your grandson.
Yes, please.
We're interested.
We're here, please. We should try and get back up there and see Lloyd again,
yeah,
for sure.
It was a great experience, and it just goes to show the things you can find when you just drive. And you're not in a rush to get somewhere. It really is about the experiences you garner while doing it.
Right, it's all about exploring and getting out there on the road and seeing what you see. And obviously, the Yugo was a
terrible car.
Terrible car. Worst car I've ever owned, but I look at it as I bought that car for the experience of meeting Lloyd and the guy I bought the car from. And when I left Lloyd's place, he had a white Volkswagen tailgate from a Volkswagen pickup truck. I said, Lloyd, can I buy that tailgate? He says, yeah, how about $50? I said, how about $100? You know, bought the tailgate from him, and now it's at our studio. And I will forever remember that tailgate as a piece of Lloyd. And I told Lloyd, I'll never, ever forget you. And he was a very special man. And it was really great. And it never would have happened without buying this horrible car. Yes, which truly, I can tell you, it is the worst car I have ever owned. And I've owned...
You've owned some other cars.
I have. So, as you guys know, I own a Porsche, which is a 1972 911T, which is kind of the crappy one. It had Zenith... The base model had Zenith carburetors. Nobody wants it. And honestly, it's really not that nice of a car. As they said, I've got it cut in half in my garage, but... it was a long journey for me to get that car. And it started out, again, with the rabbit radar out in the field, another one. I've seen a lot of rabbits in fields. There's one waiting for me in Colorado next time I go over there. I know exactly where it is.
There we go.
And I saw this red rabbit sitting in a field, and it was on my way to my wife's parents' cabin. And eventually I pulled in, and I knocked on the door. Nobody answered. Maybe 3 years of every time we went to the cabin, I would knock on this guy's door, and he was never there. Eventually, he answered the door, and I said, hey, how much do you want for that rabbit over there parked next to the Datsun 510 pickup truck, oddly enough, which was rusted and gone. There's no chance for that thing. And he said, oh, how about...
Because you thought about it.
Of course. A 510 pickup truck? That thing's awesome. So we actually ended up $250. Okay, this thing had been... The last time it was titled was 1993, and this is probably 10 years ago. So it had been sitting in a field for 17 years or whatever. So we call up AAA. I said, hey, my car won't start. which works usually. You know, it's usually not a big deal. So they come up, and the guy goes, come on, man. He's threatening basically to tell AAA that I'm abusing the service. I said, oh, no, do the guy. I gave him a little bit of extra money. And we sledgehammered the wheels to get the thing to roll again. Pulled it up on the trailer. This was a diesel, and I got it home. I took the injection pump apart, poured a bunch of ATF in it, let it sit overnight, went back up, fired right up. So, $250 car, fired right up. The thing had no rust somehow. It was preserved by being frozen in the earth. Yeah. I have no idea how this thing wasn't a rusty toilet, but it was very, very clean.
You're basically an archaeologist at this point.
At that point, yes. Yeah. That was an archaeological find. So I ended up selling that. I swapped another motor into it. I found out why it was parked originally. It's because the rear main seal was leaking, but I did not find that out till I was in, like, Indiana or something. So I bought a can of brake cleaner, like a or a big case of brake cleaner, and all the way home, every probably 100 miles, I'd have to stop, open up the timing hole, and spray brake cleaner all over the clutch, you know, so I could actually continue to drive the car to get home. That was a long, long journey. So anyway, I swapped the motor in that. I sold that car for $4,500. Good deal. And after that, I bought another Rabbit pickup truck, and that motor ended up being bad a week after I bought it. So I put in a TDI engine in that one. So that ended up getting like 60 miles per gallon. Great truck. It was kind of the height of the pricing of those trucks. People are really weird about them. And then I sold that for $8,500. And then I bought a Scirocco that was basically a parts car. So it was a chrome yellow Scirocco. It's almost the same color as that 2002 color, the orange. That, you know, some of the 2002s with the round taillights, the same orange those were. And but it was a car full of parts, the seats, the wiring harness, the motor, everything was just jammed in there. But it had been repainted. So I fixed that thing up. And on a funny story is I sold that thing for $15,000. No, wait, $10,000. I think that was 10, maybe 11. I don't remember. Regardless. Anyway, so they come to pick the car up. The guy gives me the money. I put the money on the roof of the car. I said, and it's in my driveway. I said, all right, thanks. Yeah, see you later. Drove him to the airport, came home. Truck came to pick up the car the next day. Drove away, and I go, where's the money? I go out my front door, and this is an hour after the truck left. The envelope with the $10,000 in cash is laying in the middle of the street. But that money was the money that I used as a seed to get my first Porsche, which was a white 911 SC, which I rebuilt the motor on and did everything to the tune of, I don't know, it's ridiculous how expensive the stuff is, but it was, you know, $10,000 to rebuild the engine to stock. And I've never spent that much money on something and not had it be faster. You know, every time you want to put money into a car, you want it to be faster. You do cams or chips or whatever, but this was just awfully boring. A stock 911 SC is a pretty boring car. Don't let anybody tell you any different. So I sold that thing and bought this car, and it's been quite the journey. I've driven this car probably, and I don't want you guys to think of this as a Porsche or a BMW or any mark. I just want you to think of this car as a tool. I want you to think of all of your cars as just tools. Obviously, we love the brands that we love, and a lot of that is we get together with groups like this, and we can have camaraderie and enjoy each other's company. But in reality, these cars are just tools for exploration, whether that's exploring down in the roads south of here in the Mississippi River Valley, or for me, I've driven this car probably 60,000 miles in the last 6 years, which has been many times out to Monterey, out to the East Coast. I'm planning a trip from Mexico up to the Arctic Ocean in this car. But I wanted to tell you guys one story about this car that, you know, one of the reasons why I think that people don't necessarily go out and drive these cars or any of these old cars is they have a fear of adversity. They have a fear that they're going to, something's going to break, they're going to break down. And I can tell you right now, it's going to happen. things are going to happen to you for better or for worse. And in the end, when you look back on it, the adversity is kind of the best part of all of it. So I was driving probably in Oregon on my way out to Rennsport, which is, you know, the Porsche Club's big thing that they do out in Monterey. And I started hearing this little, kind of like this noise, and I kind of rolled the window down and stuck my ear up. I'm like, ooh, it got a little bit louder. And then it got a little bit louder, and then pretty soon it was doing this, and it was this loud. It sounded like a prop airplane, essentially. And it got so loud that I'm just in the car absolutely cringing, just trying to get to the hotel. I just couldn't believe how awful it sounded.
About 1,800 miles from home?
Yeah, in the middle of nowhere in Oregon, in the dark, in the mountains somewhere. It was stressful, to say the least. So I pull up into my hotel, and I get on Instagram. I'm like, oh, yeah, this sucks. I'm stranded. I was trying to figure out what to do. I was writing an article for a Porsche magazine about my trip. I was like, am I going to call Porsche and try and – how am I going to finish this article? I'm not even there. I was like, can I get a new car? Can I just get a new 911 and then all of a sudden write a contrast piece about a new 911 versus an old 911, which broke? And I'm like, well, that's not going to be a good story. And but anyway, I woke up in the morning, and I had a message from a guy named Cameron. He says, hey – I'm about an hour south of you. I found you a transmission. Just get here. So,
and you don't know this guy.
I've never met this guy before. I have no idea who he is. And I'm sure almost anybody in the Porsche community or the BMW community would do the same thing, or the Ford community would do the same thing. This is a special bond of people that have that share these interests like us. So I get to his shop. He found a transmission for me after much searching, and he took me for a ride in his 356 at 90 degrees to go get a clutch cable because it didn't fit the new transmission. And 12 hours later, I was on the road again. And it's one of the best memories I have with my car is meeting Wayland and experiencing that stuff. There was the noise was so bad. I can't even impress upon you guys how nervous I was. I actually changed the gear oil in a gas station parking lot. I'm like, okay, we got to find out what's wrong with this thing. Maybe the gear oil's low. I don't know. And this guy had this brand new nice slab. It's like a brand new gas station, and I spilled gear oil all over the poor guy's cement, and there was physical teeth. What ended up being was the ring and pinion gear, the transmission, which drives the differential, which drives the wheels, had lost all of its teeth. So they were all kind of like, I couldn't even believe it still worked. And we ended up being in a place called the Lost Coast, and where I was so angry that I was basically Kimi Räikkönen-ing this thing everywhere I possibly could, trying to get through, trying to get to where I could stop, where I didn't have to listen to it anymore. I cannot believe it survived. It's absolutely wild. So,
but that just goes to show it's about the community.
It is about the community, and it's about helping everybody. Together. But it's I just want everybody to know that yes, things will happen, but it's okay. It's okay. You can still get out there and drive, and you can explore, whether you're exploring at Brainerd or you're exploring driving super far, or you're not, or you're just going out for dinner with your wife. Just as long as you're taking the car and exploring, that's kind of what it's all about.
Absolutely.
All right.
Well, and with that, let's get on to the actual podcast.
Yeah, let's do it. So we do these, the podcast is kind of news. We do history stories. We do kind of current events. This is one of Jake's history stories. I have no idea what this is about, by the way. So I don't know. I take no responsibility for what's going to happen in the next 20 minutes or so.
Right. So seeing as how this is a BMW club, I thought it might be fitting to dig into the history of BMW. But rather than ramble on about what I imagine most of you already know, namely that it's an old German company that used to make airplanes, I wanted to focus on a lesser known chapter in the company's history. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. Let's start from the beginning. And I should preface, for those of you who aren't familiar with our show, this is meant for entertainment more than accuracy, especially when it comes to my terrible pronunciations and accents, which, by way of hands, how many people here actually speak German? I don't even speak English.
Apparently. Anybody speak German? One,
okay.
Two.
Wow. Well,
we're sorry.
This is going to be terrible for you.
And we're sorry.
It's going to be terrible. Okay, Carl Frederick Rapp was born on the 24th of September, 1882. Now, not much is known of his early life. However, it became apparent that young Carl had the mind of an engineer, and he soon found himself employed by Robert Zust, who was an Italian industrialist.
It seems like all of our stories start with somebody who was an engineer. I like that.
Well, it's a car podcast.
Yeah,
so yes,
that's true.
Yeah. Mr. Zust made his fortune operating a precision tool manufacturing plant in northern Italy. However, that's not where our friend Carl was employed. No, instead, Mr. Zust was experimenting with a pet project of his own, the newfangled automobile. Zust established a company to develop prototypes of cars.
You're not pronouncing Zeus. It's not Zeiss, is it? Because that's...
No, it's just a U with the umlaut.
Okay.
Zust.
Yeah, I just making
Zust.
Sure.
That's German.
Just based on your track record,
Zust,
I'm making
yes,
sure.
Yes, not great. Zust established a company to develop prototypes of cars and commercial vehicles. So the name of the company was, fittingly enough, Zust Automotive.
Has anybody heard of Zust Automotive?
I don't know. Zust Automotive. No, this is 1908 or whatever.
Okay.
And so young Carl Rapp began his engineering career developing engines for Zust in 1908. After putting in a few years with Zust, he had a short stint working with some other guy named Carl Benz, who I'm sure never went on to do anything noteworthy. Never heard of this Benz guy. However, the same year, the Flugwerk Deutschland GmbH was established. Now, Chris, I'd like to take a little sidebar, as sometimes we do. If you ever come across the name of a German company, which being German enthusiasts, I'm sure some of you have, you'll hear that acronym quite often, GmbH.
Right. What does that mean?
Well, do you know what it stands for, Chris?
No.
I had to look it up, guys. It stands for German made, but haphazard. No. It's actually General Motors, but with Helga. Get my big hammer?
That one I'm familiar with, yes.
Gently Making Better Ham. Mm. Or my personal favorite, Germans mostly... Oh, no, I skipped one. There we go. Yeah. Or...
Oh, Jesus.
Hold on. Hold on. I can't believe I... All right, I'm not going to say that one. Okay, in all seriousness, GmbH stands for Geschäft mit beschränkten Haftung.
What does this mean?
Which literally translates to limited liability company. So that really has nothing to do with the story. But now you're all a little bit smarter, so you're welcome. Okay. So anyways, this Flugwerk Deutschland GmbH was, as you may have guessed by the name, a newly founded aircraft manufacturer. And as it turns out, aircraft need engines. So the company hired our friend.
Was there anything for Germans to do back then other than make planes and cars? Every seems like every German engineer was making planes and cars, and that's all you ever hear about.
Well, there's tractors and other motorcycles.
Nice, that's true.
Yep. So the company hired Carl to design the engines, but that was actually quite short-lived. Only a year later, the company was dissolved. Apparently, their airplanes were complete crap.
That's one thing you don't want, bad airplane.
However, as they say, Chris, every failure is an opportunity, especially for an aspiring young engineer.
So how Carl, old is this guy at this time? Do we know?
1908. He was, let's say, 26, because okay. I can't remember when he was born.
Okay, we'll just guess. In
so
26, sure.
Carl took assets from this manufacturer and, with an investment partner, founded his own company right there on the same grounds, Rapp Motorwerke. German people? That was good, yeah? Okay, no. One of Rapp's first engine designs was called the Rapp 1 and was, fittingly enough, an inline 6. And on paper, this engine should sound fairly similar to what we know today. The design used overhead cams, liquid cooling, and hardened steel cylinder liners.
How was their cooling system?
Probably better than Porsche's. The engine made 125 horsepower, which I thought was pretty impressive for 1913. However, it becomes a little less impressive when I tell you the displacement of 15 liters. So this probably isn't the best candidate for any of you looking to do an E30 swap.
No, not going to make it.
So the engine continued development and evolved over the next couple of years, and by the time World War I broke out, Carl was developing the Rapp 3 engine, making 175 horsepower,
ooh,
which seemed like pretty good timing for the company.
You know, eventually BMW went on to do extremely high horsepower per displacement. It didn't start here, though.
Not here. No, 15 liters for 125. No, so he's basically evolving this engine, and it's good timing because the German military were soon placing massive orders with the company. However, there was a bit of a problem. You see, these are airplane engines, Chris, and what do airplanes need to do?
Crash.
No.
Fly! They need to fly. Okay. Yeah.
So here we have a massively heavy 15-liter engine that Carl made even more heavy to support the increased power output. The engines were so heavy and developed such severe vibration, they were deemed unusable in aircraft.
All right, so what are we putting them in instead? What,
no, nothing.
Nothing?
No, the reputation...
That's my first thing. If an engine doesn't work in this, it'll work in that. What's...
The reputation of the Rapp engines was tarnished as soon as the first deliveries were made, and the German military immediately ceased all purchases. So fast forward to 1917. Another designer, Max Fritz, was brought on board to rework these troubled designs. By fixing the inherent balance of the engine, the inline six-cylinder finally took on its notoriously silky smooth attribute and turned the engine into a success both mechanically and commercially. Investors and senior management realized that Fritz was not only a much better designer than Rapp, he was basically responsible for saving this company. But the man whose name was on the building didn't quite agree. And it became clear that Karl Rapp's pride was holding the company back. And so on July 25th, 1917, the other partners in the company voted to terminate Karl's contract.
Oh.
However, if you oust the man whose name was lent to the company, you'd better damn well find a new name. Rapp Motorwerke was renamed Bayerische Motorwerken GmbH for the German state of Bavaria, in which the company operated. However, to everyone else, it was simply known as BMW. The BMW logo, on the other hand, was actually an evolution of the Rapp Motorwerke company logo, which was contained in a black circle. The new BMW logo retained that circle and included the blue and white colors of the Bavarian flag. Now, the origin of the BMW logo is often thought to signify the movement of an aircraft propeller with the white blades cutting through a blue sky.
That's what I've always heard, yeah.
However, this portrayal was first used in a BMW advertisement in 1929, 12 years after the logo was created, so that propeller blade logo story is actually nothing more than a myth.
Okay.
Okay. Regardless, it wasn't long before the aircraft engine manufacturer began branching out into different products. The first BMW motorcycle, the R32, came into the market in 1923. 1933 saw the company's first completely new self-developed car, the 303. And those airplane engines, BMW ceased production of aircraft engines altogether after the Second World War.
So do we know what the badge originally meant?
Yeah, it's the flag.
Oh, okay. It's I thought there was maybe flag. Something a little bit more than that.
No, okay. I just told you.
All right.
So Second World War, something else happened at the end of the Second World War. The Yalta Conference, also known as the Crimea Conference, was a meeting of the Allied powers that divided up the defeated Nazi Germany into occupation zones. As we now know, this left East Germany in Soviet control, and as it happens, one of BMW's factories was located in that Soviet occupation zone.
Whenever I look at old German cars that I'm taking apart, I always like to see made in East Germany. I'm like, who? By who?
But rather than shut down a perfectly good factory, the Soviets just continued producing cars and motorcycles under the BMW name for 7 years. That's when BMW corporate got wind of this and decided that a rogue faction of its own company shouldn't be producing cars for the Soviets. So BMW filed a lawsuit against the Soviet operation, which I don't understand how that works.
I wonder if it's
Chris.
Pretty easy to not get served if on the other side of the Berlin Wall.
Right.
How are they going to find you?
What happens when you sue a company in the Soviet Union? What's to stop them from just saying, screw you, pound sand, right?
Yeah.
So I don't get that. Regardless, the Soviets must have figured it would be easier to simply change the name of the company and avoid whatever sort of international conflict that might have launched. So while BMW was named after Bavaria, the state, the Soviets, not being overly creative, just changed the name to the town the factory was operating in, Eisenach. So Bayerischen Motorwerke became Eisenacher Motorwerke. And just as they're called BMW, the Soviet company was known as EMW.
EMW?
EMW. So Chris, you want the BMW? Nein. In Soviet Union, you get EMW.
Perfect.
Yeah. The creative branding experts of the Soviet Union weren't quite finished, though. After all, that infamous BMW logo simply wouldn't do. Continuing their innovative, original thinking, they took the BMW logo, replaced Bayerische with Eisenacher.
Do you know how hard it was to get a car in the Soviet Union?
I'm sure
you had to wait months and months and years to get a car. There was a guy who was talking to his official and said, hey, I need to get a hold of my car. I want to buy a car. He says, well, when are you free? I said, well, I'm free in about 15 years. He's like, well, what do you mean 15 years? The guy says, oh, well, that's when the plumber's coming.
I've heard that joke.
It's a great joke. It's a bad joke. But yeah. Really, it was very, very, very difficult to get a car in the Soviet
sure.
Union. So I wonder how many of these they were actually able to sell.
It was only like 600.
Okay.
But we won't go there. So regardless, the Bayerischen was Eisenacher, and they changed the color blue of the logo to that of the Soviet state red. And that was literally all they did to change the logo. It's just red. Of course, their manufacturing prowess wasn't any more innovative. In 1954, EMW started making the 327 model, which was, as you might have guessed, simply a BMW 327. But here's what you need to realize. BMW first sold the 327 model in 1937. So EMW was taking a nearly two-decade-old design and re-releasing it to their fellow comrades.
It sounds very Russian.
Yes, it does. And Chris, it's not like EMW was just building a clone of these old BMWs. No, EMW was using the actual BMW tooling that had been left behind in that Eisenach factory. So legend has it that these Soviet factory workers would simply grind off the loops of the letter B in various castings, making BMW read EMW.
Convenient.
Wow. And that's basically, that sums up the level of EMW's road car production.
I'm wondering what these things are worth. They must be just crazy rare.
Yeah. And as it turns out, the company wasn't very long-lived either. So Eisenacher Motorwerke was shut down in 1956, having been folded into some other hideously terrible communist car company. I think they may have been forced to make Ladas at that point.
Or Trabants or something.
Yes. Yeah. After all, without capitalism, Chris, competition amongst state-owned companies would just be inefficient.
That's true.
So that's the end of the story with EMW. But that's not the end of the story for us. You see, if there's one thing that Soviets wanted more than communism, it was to show the rest of the world just how great communism was.
Right.
And as you may recall, or in my case, have read because I'm too young, communist propaganda was rampant during the Cold War. And what better way to show the supposed superiority of Soviet Eastern Germany than to go racing? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm all for it. I can't imagine communist racing. Have you seen some of the build quality of these cars?
It's not great, which is why we're telling this story. The state-owned Soviet racing program was called the Ren Collective, or Racing Collective, which I think is very communist-sounding. Quote, in contrast to West Germany, where profit is still the highest priority, there is truly sporting spirit within the Ren Collective. Its only task is to bring our automotive industry to the highest possible standard of development and to bring up a team of highly talented experts who drive for their native land and whose cars are living proof of the quality and precision labor of the working people.
That way you can drive to get your bread and stand in the bread line really, really fast.
Yeah.
Now, I only bring this up because in 1953, this Ren Collective would be operated as a part of the EMW. Now, it's worth noting this wasn't the first racing effort by the Eastern Germans. The Soviet Ren Collective had already campaigned.
Because right on the other side of the Berlin Wall, we've got the Avus racetrack.
Right.
No, wait, was the Avus track in
that was pre-war.
East or West Germany? Does anybody know East or West Germany? Nobody? Avus racetrack was pretty well famous. Right. I wonder if they were there.
No, they had their R1 chassis, the Soviets did, that they raced with mixed success in inter-German Formula 2 races the previous years. This was no doubt due to the fact that it was basically BMW technology, right? However, given the pressure from the state to develop a truly dominant Grand Prix car, EMW would begin work on designing an entirely new racing car. The whole effort, from design and construction of the car to the competition in races, was managed by the Soviet bureaucracy.
Ooh.
Because of this, EMW wouldn't be able to quickly change and take advantage of regulation changes that's inherent in Formula 2 racing at the time. Instead, the Soviets decided to focus on sports car racing. So, Chris, rather than continuing in a series where you have experience with a chassis that is competitive, if not outdated, let's scrap all that, throw it out the window, and completely change everything to the sports car series that they have no experience
in. So are these still based on the old tooling that they were using from this factory?
At this point, they're trying to make their own race cars.
Okay.
So the new race car was rushed.
Clearly didn't do very good. I've never heard of this company before.
Right. So the new race car was rushed through design and production just in time to make its debut at the last race of the 1953 season in Bernau. Now, back in the days of split Germany, this Bernau was a sort of refuge for the East German political elite. Therefore, the race would be the perfect place for these high-ranking comrades to marvel in the superiority of the new racing car, dubbed the EMW R2. So, let's take a moment to talk about
this car. I mean, it looks like every other car from that era.
Yeah, it's a single-seat chassis, aluminum bodywork, had a front-engine, rear-drive layout. The engine was actually based off of that of an old BMW 328 inline six. And one of the most important aspects of the new car's design was the rear suspension. So the old EMW design had used the antiquated live rear axle. It's literally just the straight axle.
Because it's 20 years old.
Right.
Yeah.
The new car used a D. Dion design, which I have to interject and say, when I read this story to my wife last night, she thought I was stuttering. D. Dion. It's French, which is De Dion. So if you don't know what a De Dion layout
is. Sounds expensive. Yeah.
It's actually an independent rear suspension, center differential, U-joints on both the axles. But instead of the wheels being able to move independent of each other, they each are connected via a rigid beam, which is sprung by leaf springs. So basically, it doesn't have any of the benefits of an independent rear suspension and is more fragile than a solid layout. So the car's debut. Once the car was unloaded at the track, it set out on a practice lap where the rear suspension promptly broke.
So did they do any testing on this thing prior, or were they so confident? Is this it with broken suspensions?
Yeah,
is this
guy
trying to figure it out?
Yeah, he's having a bad day. So the incident was a huge embarrassment, and rather than try to repair the design and risk it breaking again in competition, they simply packed it up and withdrew from the race. But, as I mentioned, Bernau was the final race of that 1953 season. And, as it would turn out, the car never returned to the world stage in 1954.
Not surprising.
FIA regulations were tweaked that year to allow more displacement, but rather than attempting to make a car competitive, the East German bureaucracy decided to simply race the car in its own borders.
Yeah, it's too good for everybody else.
Right, so an East German-only championship was organized just so this EMW R2 car could live up to the hype that the Soviet press had been touting. Then in 1956, when EMW was dissolved, so was the Wren Collective.
I wonder how many drivers sacrificed themselves for the good of the people.
And didn't go anywhere with it. No. The Soviets had seemingly given up on attempting to show any superiority through racing, and I imagine that effort was completely overshadowed by the fact that the then-looming space race was basically happening.
Right.
Regardless, the Eisenacher Motorwerke is an interesting, if not obscure, part of BMW's history, one which I hope you have enjoyed.
Yeah, I've never heard of EMW before.
That's, yeah, you have a BMW, there's also EMW.
Thanks, guys. So you guys have any questions for us about buying and selling cars? You want to hear about my the worst car buying decision I've ever made was with a BMW?
I thought it was the Yugo.
No, that was the worst car I've ever owned. It was actually a really good decision because of meeting Lloyd. This is a long time ago. I'd always lusted after this Volkswagen Mark II, which is kind of like an 88 to 92 Golf. And it had a VR6 swap on it, and it was really, really, really a nice car. And in the interim, while that car was, it shifted a few owners, you know, kind of went through a few different owners at the time. But again, radar out, I saw this E30. It was a red E30 325 IS, black sport interior. Perfect. The car these days would probably be worth at least $10,000 or $12,000. It was the nicest red E30 ever. I bought that car. I think it was $3,000 at the time. Wild. And then all of a sudden, this red Mark II that I'd always wanted comes up for sale, and I sold that red E30 to buy this Mark II, which ended up being a clapped-out nightmare that I got pulled over for and arrested because everything was everything was illegal on that car. So that was the worst mistake I've ever made buying a BMW. Great car. The worst mistake was selling that car.
There you go.
Do you have any questions for us? Anything you'd like to hear? Or should we call it good? Good? All right. Thanks for having
us.
I really, really appreciate you talking about all this. And if you have any questions, want to come and talk to us afterward or want to find out how to listen to the podcast, we'll be here. Thank you. Thanks for having us, guys. Thank you.